The Sunstone Foundation presents the new Psychobiology and Moral Responsibility, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
And may I ask the universal question, can you hear me in the rear? Thank you. I'm Ben Taylor. I've been asked to be the moderator of this panel. There are a few sort of nuts and bolts comments that I've been advised to bring to your attention again. We certainly welcome you here, and I can tell you it's a very rewarding sight seeing so many persons here, and I think we'll have a very interesting time of it. The proceedings of this and all sessions are taped, as you know. You're asked not to tape individually, please, and tapes of each session, or as you may desire them, can be obtained afterward out in the foyer. We have three gentlemen on our panel today. The general topic, as you may know, is the new psychobiology and moral responsibility. To me, that conjures up an abundance of possibilities and questions. I have at various times in my own mind, not overtly necessarily, talked about it, but wondered about such things as the laws of thermodynamics and moral responsibility. So I'm looking forward to this discussion. Sorry about that, Louie, but I have thought about it. I'll introduce the panel members, all of them at this time, and we will proceed in the order in which the introductions are made. First is Dr. R. Jan Stout, Assistant Clinical Professor of Psychiatry, University of Utah, and a psychiatrist in private practice. He will speak to the topic sin and sexuality. He has advised me that he may and will, among other topics and areas, speak to new evidence concerning the genesis of homosexuality. We also have with us Paul Winder. The program says Winder, and Paul tells me he's from a modest Czechoslovakian family, was it, Paul? The prominent Utahns I know ran a dairy. Is that the one you're speaking of? In any event, Paul Winder, professor of psychiatry, University of Utah, and author of the book Mind, Mood, and Medicine. Paul will speak about the role of heredity and psychobiologic and other factors in human behavior. Our third panel member is Harold Miller, professor of psychology at Brigham Young University and also happens to be a stake president. I just spoke briefly with Harold, and he told me that he came not with a sheaf of notes, but rather expecting to speak in a dialogue with the audience, which I hope really a lot is done. But in any event, he will speak extemporaneously, as it were, to the subject behaviorism and the gospel. So, having introduced these gentlemen, we'll proceed in the order mentioned, and following the presentations, there will be a period for questions and observations from the audience. Now, there's supposed to be a microphone present. I've not been able to locate it. Does anyone have a microphone next to them out there? If not, I would be happy to repeat your questions so that everyone will know to what the topic and idea these gentlemen are responding. Let's proceed then in the order as mentioned.
Thank you very much. In the fall of 1970, I was a young psychiatrist with 5 years of clinical practice. I'd been certified by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. I felt that I grasped the basic and the latest theories concerning the cause and the cure of homosexuality and the other so-called sexual deviations. I've been asked to participate in a televised panel discussion on this subject, KUED, to examine what I considered a very provocative subject. I prepared for this by reviewing various texts on the subject, which almost universally presented the following thesis and the prevailing thesis. Homosexuality is a learned behavior, an illness to be treated and corrected, and with proper therapy can be cured in over 25% of cases. It represented a failure, psychoanalytically speaking, to successfully traverse the pitfalls of psychosexual development, as had been outlined by our guru, Sigmund Freud. To be sure, there were scattered reports in the literature suggesting genetic and a hormonal basis to this disorder, but these were not very convincing to the vast majority of clinicians, including myself. It was and still is considered a major sexual sin by my church, my culture, and indeed the entire Judeo-Christian tradition stretching back over 2,000 years. This was certainly understood, if not openly discussed, in that TV panel of 1970. After presenting my views and the current literature on the subject, I felt satisfied, confident, and correct. There was no serious debate on the issue, and I returned home to the congratulations of my wife, my friends, and my colleagues. 15 years later, I can now state that what I presented was wrong, naive, and overly simplistic. It will now be my goal to explain the evolution of my own views on this subject, as well as the current thinking of others, which is clarifying some of the mysteries surrounding the development of human sexuality, and more specifically, homosexuality, transsexualism, and transvestitism. The implications that all of this might have on the subject of sin and moral responsibility seems enormous, and none of us can escape facing the dilemma. For perhaps 1 in 10 of all men and a smaller percentage of women are directly involved in these questions. There are few subjects that can arouse and confuse and intrigue and provoke us like the study of human sexuality. From the book of Genesis to Freud to Masters and Johnson, onward to Desmond Morris's The Naked Ape, the search for the understanding of this complex behavior and experience goes on. And the music of sexuality plays throughout life, from infancy to senility. It waxes, it wanes. It reaches moments of intensity and crescendo and long periods of plateau, and is ultimately a powerful symphonic backdrop to life itself. In the human being, sexuality binds and it splits relationships. It confuses and enlightens them. It can produce profound ecstasy as well as unbearable guilt. Only in the 20th century, utilizing the scientific method, have we been able to study the phenomenon of sexuality with sophisticated neurobiological, anatomical, and hormonal research. There's a great deal of folklore which surrounds this subject, and we are in the process of trying to separate fact from fiction. The brain is the ultimate sexual organ, and everything else will flow from it. There's a complex interplay of the neocortex, or the cerebrum, the limbic system, the hypothalamus, and the brainstem. All of these structures contribute to the sexual experience. Hormones, especially testosterone, fuel a system in both males and females. That's a point I want to emphasize today. Testosterone is the fuel in both males and females. We need to look at embryology. The process of sexual differentiation begins with the chance meeting of a sperm and egg in conception, and this begins a cascade of events that ultimately produce a defined, sexually oriented male or female. To understand human sexuality, one must first understand embryology. This is the science of intrauterine development of the fetus. We are absolutely lost if we ignore this crucial phase of our existence. Dr. John Money, the founder of Johns Hopkins Psychohormonal Research Unit, says that the basic embryonic plan, at least for mammals, is inherently female, the Eve principle, as he calls it. For we all start out female. Either the Bible or biology got this wrong, I'm not sure yet. But we all start out female, the Eve principle, from an embryonic sense, and then a little more than one half of us respond to the so-called Adam principle as the result of the Y chromosome. It acts upon undifferentiated fetal gonads to create testes. Thereafter, the change to male seems inexorably controlled by male hormones, the androgens. Nature seems to have a much harder time creating males in the arena of sexual identity as well as anatomy. This may in part help explain the fact that there are more males than females who experience these various sexual types. Testosterone both defeminizes and masculinizes the brain. and it's now postulated that neural pathways are imprinted at crucial stages of brain development, which will later have a profound effect on sexual behavior and the choice of a sexual object. Certainly, without the secretions from the embryonic testes, no male organs can ever develop anatomically. It now seems likely that subsequent sexual feelings and fantasies are also influenced by testosterone produced in utero. Variations in the amount secreted or the blocking of this hormone's action by either maternal stress or drugs has been shown to make major differences in the eventual sexual life of the developing embryo. Animal studies, while difficult to generalize to humans, have confirmed the crucial role that prenatal androgens have in sexual behavior when puberty eventually arrives. In a few females, the excessive production of testosterone by the adrenal glands during gestation causes a relatively rare condition called the adrenogenital syndrome, AGS for short. These girls are born with masculinized genitalia that can be easily mistaken for a boy at birth. The condition can be surgically repaired and treated with hormones, and they go on to develop normal feminine physique in puberty. Yet a large percentage of these girls grow up as tomboys with little interest in dating when teenagers. As adults, a startling 37% are homosexual or bisexual, or have sexual fantasies almost exclusively about women. Again, we see that testosterone is the powerful hormone of desire that exerts its effect on both a developing male and female prior to birth. Significantly, testosterone given after puberty does not alter the direction of sexual choice, but it may intensify the general libido. Lots of homosexuals have been given testosterone, assuming that this would change their object choice. It does not. It just intensifies their direction, which has already been set. These are biological events and variations, but do not represent what we think of as true genetic disorders. The genetic inherited transmission of homosexuality has been suggested by some investigators, but current information, with the exception of a single, rather startling study, does not seem to favor this thesis. The development of sexual identity comes after conception and is unlikely to be the result of specific information carried in our chromosomes. Now, it's long been argued that behavioral sex in human beings is learned. The presumption has been that infants have a neutral gender role. Then toys, dress, play patterns, etc., all begin working to undermine, or to determine, I should say, the ultimate sexual orientation. Little girls are supposed to like pink and boys inclined to blue. Girls are given dolls and boys receive toy trains and trucks. Things are supposed to work out just fine if the child is given clear and unambiguous messages about his or her sexual destiny. As early as 1905, Sigmund Freud began probing the family backgrounds that could produce homosexuality and the sexual deviations. Every clinician, including myself, learned that passive, weak, and absent fathers, coupled with strong, dominant, and castrating mothers, set up the perfect climate for the induction of homosexuality. Indeed, many of our cases in our practices seem to bear out Freud's observations. But the problem was that all of those findings were retrospective and in selected populations. Recent research on large, randomly selected populations of homosexuals show no correlation of statistical validity with this family pattern. There are many heterosexual men with similar backgrounds, indeed brothers, who do not grow up to become gay. Other learning theories and behavioral hypotheses have been suggested, but generally are subject to the same flaws that we see in Freud's original postulates. Additionally, these theories imply that some blame for parents and families that in some mysterious way they caused or could prevent the emergence of homoerotic behavior. While these speculations can be fascinating, they ignore much of the biological basis for human sexuality. Now, I want to make clear that all of this does not mean that environmental factors are not important. For on the contrary, we can say that homosexuality, transsexuality, and transvestitism are probably multi-determined and by psychodynamic, biological, sociocultural, and situational factors. Environmental factors can profoundly shape the style, the expression, and quality of sexual behavior in all of us, whether straight or gay. Yet the material that I have presented shows there is considerable evidence for a biological determination of sexual identity and object choice, and questionable evidence for an environmental one. It seems to me that the environment fine-tunes the instrument of sexuality, but does not create, nor does it organize, the direction of the sexuality. But more difficult research needs to be done but we must say now that the evidence accumulated over the past 15 years for the biological causality of sexual and gender identity, while inconclusive, is becoming quite persuasive. Now we need to talk about sin, sexuality, and religion. Religions have a vested interest in advocating a sexual code of conduct. The Judeo-Christian tradition has long regarded the monogamous human family as the finest and the best way to rear offspring in an environment of loving security and moral integrity. Anything that threatens this goal becomes a danger to the achievement of a moral universe. It's not surprising that homosexuality and the other sexual variations under discussion are met with such antipathy in our culture. From the Apostle Paul to modern-day prophets, there has been strong condemnation of these practices. For many years, in the Mormon Church, homosexuality was referred to as, quotes, the sin that has no name. It wasn't until the 1940s that they finally came out and started referring to that particular disorder or variation. Clearly, there has been no home for homosexuals in either the Christian or the Jewish faiths. In other cultures, attitudes toward homosexuality vary widely. In a study of 76 societies done in 1952, it was observed that 64% this behavior was considered normal and acceptable, at least for some of the members of that community. In the remaining 36% of societies where homosexuality was condemned, such practices continue to take place in secret. The accepted assumption has been that homosexuals have chosen their lifestyle as a result, and as a result of choosing this lifestyle, have entered into sin. Spencer W. Kimball has written, quotes, homosexuality is an ugly sin, repugnant to those who find no temptation in it, as well as to many past offenders who are seeking a way out of its clutches, unquotes. Society at large has generally agreed with this conclusion. Patrick J. Buchanan, now a White House staffer, implied divine punishment in the AIDS plague. In 1983, he wrote, the poor homosexuals, they have declared war on nature, and now nature is exacting an awful retribution. He apparently made no reference to the plight of innocent children, hemophiliacs, and others who contracted the disease AIDS. We need to ask ourselves, do homosexuals, transsexuals, and transvestites consciously choose their sexual identities? Are they more capable of doing this than those of us who are heterosexual? Is not sexual identity something to which we awaken rather than something we decide by some rational or moral process? Do any of you remember choosing to be straight when you were 13? I certainly don't. I've never met nor treated a homosexual who felt he or she had a choice in the matter. From their earliest recollections, they knew that in some way they were different, and universally they felt confused, conflicted, and frightened. There's a special and a poignant pain for the Mormon homosexual. How can he or she fit into the celestial plan of things? Where do these persons go to resolve the conflict surging within their realm of moral responsibility? And how do they reconcile their feelings with divine revelation? There have been sensitive and thoughtful articles in Sunstone and Dialogue which examine this issue. Marvin Ridding, in a recent Sunstone column, acknowledges, quotes, I do not know the answer, but I do know that I cannot condemn my gay friends, nor can I insist that they change, nor that they should forego love. All I can do is care about them and accept them. I am convinced the gospel of Christ has room for them. I hope that someday the church can make room for them too. John Bennion, in the summer 1985 issue of Dialogue that's just out, writes a fictional but illustrative interview between a tormented young man and his state president. There is acceptance, there's love, there's empathy expressed, but certainly no resolution to the agonizing dilemma of his homosexuality. Let's talk about the clinical spectrum now of homosexuality. The personality spectrum among homosexuals is as diverse and complex as it is among the heterosexual population. From passive ones to aggressive ones, from shy introverts to loud and raucous extroverts, from theatrical, hysterical personalities to rigid, compulsive, obsessive ones, from the sexually inhibited to the timid types, and all the way to sexually promiscuous, flamboyant ones, from radical activists to staunch conservatives, from defiant atheists to devout churchgoers, from unconscionable sociopaths to highly responsible, law-abiding citizens. The stereotype of the limp-wristed, effeminate fag is just about as distorted as the Rambo male is for heterosexual men. Did you like that picture of Ronald Reagan atop the body of Rambo? That was that's what made me think of that little line. Every occupation, social class, race, and creed are represented in the gay world. Many are married, have children, lead quiet and conservative lifestyles. The level of sexual drive is also very highly variable, as is the exclusivity of homosexual interest. That is, homosexuality is a spectrum itself. A 1970 study of participants in the impersonal sex of public restrooms found that 54% of them were married, living with their wives and children in middle-class homes, and for all intents and purposes, just average guys next door. Within the Mormon Church, the same variations occur. In an anonymous monograph published in 1978, the author, himself a homosexual and a Mormon, states, "We belong to your priesthood quorums. We teach your Sunday school class. We pass the sacrament to you each Sunday. We attend your primary class, your faculty meetings, your family reunions, your youth conferences. We sell you your groceries. We keep your books. We police your streets and teach your children in school. We preside over your wards and even your stakes. We are your sons, your brothers, your grandsons. And who knows, by some riddle of nature, we would be you. From my own clinical experience of 20 years, I can attest to this diversity in our community. The families of homosexuals, whether parents, wives, husbands, siblings, or children, must often live with confusion, anger, shame, and sorrow. They feel helpless, guilty, and impotent in dealing with these situations. Single-parent mothers worry that their particular circumstances will foster the development of sexual inversion when a strong male figure is not available for their sons." In his famous letter to an American mother, Sigmund Freud wrote, and this was in the 1930s, I believe, "Homosexuality is assuredly no advantage, but it is nothing to be ashamed of. No vice, no degradation. It cannot be classified as an illness. We consider it to be a variation of sexual functions produced by a certain arrest of sexual development." Now, he was thinking, I think, of psychosexual arrest. But what I'm talking about is a biological arrest or alteration. "There are men who will struggle for years to change their orientation or to experience an inkling of heterosexual interest. Beyond traditional psychotherapy, scripture reading, and church counseling, some have sat for hours viewing pictures of naked men while receiving painful electric shocks for negative behavioral conditioning." This has happened right here in Salt Lake and other areas in the state. "Some of these will claim a cure, which many will view with skepticism. Others accept with resignation their situation, while still others become bitter, disillusioned, and nihilistic. There are those who state they have found love, comfort, and self-acceptance in their homosexuality. The specter of excommunication can loom over all of those who refuse to change their ways. The most tragic cases seek the ultimate out of suicide. Whenever I see a young, active Mormon single who has taken his life, this thought flashes through my mind. Was he struggling with a sexual identity crisis? A minority choose to lead abstinent, celibate, or so-called morally neutral lives. The capacity to choose this situation and solution also varies widely, just as it does with heterosexuals. How many priests are there among us? In addition to many homosexuals, I have worked with a few transsexuals and transvestites. These situations represent a different level of core sexual identity and sex role behavior, respectively. A female transsexual may live with the absolute belief that she is male and be willing to undergo multiple painful surgical procedures to achieve this end. Still, in another form of sexual confusion, a pseudohermaphrodite, known to be genetically female, received hormonal therapy and a hysterectomy, and eventually proceeded as a male to priesthood ordination and temple marriage. How, we must ask now, does one understand and ultimately reconcile the biological, the social, the religious, and the moral questions posed by these situations? Clearly, there is no easy solution to these most intimate of human circumstances. Not only is there confusion and misunderstanding surrounding the sexual conditions we've discussed, there's blatant hostility, rejection, and scorn toward the human beings involved. The hatred and the revulsion can so distort reality that no redeeming qualities are ever acknowledged. Many gays will internalize and accept society's abhorrence of their own sexual preference and become their own worst persecutors. There's also a widespread disbelief for a biological explanation in favor of a learned, chosen cause for homosexuality. Treatability and the cure questions provoke great controversy. What lies behind all these reactions to the homosexual? The severe homophobic is perhaps the easiest to understand. Now, all of us are a little bit homophobic, even homosexuals. but I'm talking about the severe homophobic. These people often harbor serious fears about their own sexual identity. They can overcompensate by showing redneck bullishness and brutal teasing of gays. Let's go out and knock over a gay. Project and displacing hatred is a common and convenient way to run from one's own psychopathology. Many people in and out of the church seem to want homosexuals held fully accountable for their sexual feelings and behavior, as was previously illustrated by Patrick Buchanan's comment regarding AIDS. Yet, if conscious choice is not involved, can we legitimately invoke a charge of sin? Or, if behavior remains untarnished, does the concept of as a man thinketh or feeleth constitute moral transgression? Does the revealed word of God, as written in the scriptures, supersede the experience and the reality of millions of homoerotic individuals? And is it morally responsible to offer promises of cure to reverse one's sexual identity? How many heterosexuals would like our sexual identity reversed by someone? Maybe if we're in great conflict with it, we would maybe try. What are the larger questions in some minds? Would God have anything to do with the creation of homosexuals or transsexuals? What kinds of tricks has nature played on us humans? Does the new psychobiology challenge our treasured concepts of human responsibility and free will? Does man's or woman's destiny reside in the intricate workings of the hormones and the spiral helix of DNA? Well, I cannot answer these questions, nor do I expect that any of you can fully explain them. But perhaps the best we can hope for is the willingness to reject prejudice, ignorance, and self-righteousness, and to embrace tolerance and understanding. For as life unfolds, only fools will fail to recognize that the world is brimming with such existential and spiritual dilemmas. The vast majority of these riddles have no simple and tidy solutions. And my final question would be, which of you wishes to shoulder the ultimate moral responsibility when dealing with such profound mysteries? Thank you.
Right. Not only did I become a Winder by moving to Utah, but I became a Gentile. And I am sure my Orthodox grandmother would be very upset where she knew this to have occurred after 5,700 years. Parenthetically, I shall mention Denmark momentarily. I was very curious in my own feeble genealogical way to determine whence the name Winder. And in Denmark, I once, to my surprise, discovered that the Queen of Denmark is the Queen of the Danes, Goths, and Wends, from which I assumed I was her subject. I did not take refuge in the American embassy. What I'd like to do is to follow the ostensible dictum which an elder preacher gave a younger one starting out in his career in delivering a sermon, which is to tell them what you're going to tell them, and tell them you told them. And what I would like to discuss today is the relevance of the neurobiological revolution for our understanding of the role of genetics, not only in human behavior, but particularly in human psychological pathology, in disturbed human behavior. What I'll be talking about is very nice, and it involves nothing technical, does not involve genes, restriction fragments, or any of the complicated aspects of molecular biology, which are horrifying in their complexity. Okay, what am I going to say? I'm going to say that there are certain, to use the medical jargon, syndromes, families of psychiatric disorder, and I'll mention what they are, that these syndromes, these families, are not yes or no phenomena. They're much more like intelligence or height or blood pressure. They occur along a continuum of severity. And in fact, the family notion is a very nice one because there is the notion of a family resemblance, which can be greater or lesser. Three, that these psychiatric disorders, to which there are important genetic contributions, affect a very large fraction of the population, probably somewhere between 15 and 30%. And finally, as will be obvious to you, and I will not enlarge upon them, the existence of these issues have obvious social, ethical, and theological relevance. Okay, what are the syndromes I wished to discuss? Well, actually six, and some are ethically of greater interest than others, but I think all are worthy of mention. One is schizophrenia, which is madness in the layman's sense of the word, and in its most severe instances affects a very small fraction of the population, less than 1%. And these are individuals who have delusions, hallucinations, who may be unable to think or talk coherently. Okay, they are uncommon, but their relatives, so far as symptoms are concerned, are far more common. And for every seriously ill person, there are three, four, five individuals who may be very eccentric people in a variety of ways, socially, intellectually, so on. Schizophrenia is relevant ethically because schizophrenics kill themselves. Even with good treatment, about 10 or 15% will commit suicide. The next major family of psychiatric disorders is one which is not foreign. Whenever I address an audience, I know that there are people in the room who are experiencing it. And these are the depressions which we consider to be genetic in origin, to be biologically mediated, that is, caused, and to be chemically, thank goodness, in many instances, treatable. Something very disturbing is happening about these depressions. What's happening is that their frequency is increasing at a visibly rapid rate, so that I'm able to assert that a room full of young and middle-aged adults, about 5% are currently ill, one person in 20 in this room. And in the course of their lives, about one in 20 men and one in 10 women will develop this disorder, which is not only extraordinarily painful, but and debilitating, the source of marital and familial stress, strife, divorce. And two, in the population at large, is associated with suicide. A very large number of depressed people, even if reasonably well treated, will wind up by killing themselves. Obviously, this is ethically and theologically relevant if suicide is a sin and if there are genetic contributions to sinful behavior. Suicide itself has genetic contributions, and I will mention that a little later on to give an example of how this work proceeds, which is embarrassingly simple-minded, as you'll see. Is alcoholism a disease or a manifestation of moral turpitude? I don't know. I will not argue that point, but there are genetic facts. There are data. There are facts which indicate that some forms of severe alcoholism are genetic in origin. Lastly, and this is obviously socially as well as ethically relevant, there is evidence that some forms of, or some, that the genetic contributions to some sorts of felonious behavior, and also to the personality type, which has been called by a variety of names, sociopath, psychopath, antisocial personality, which refers not only to people who transgress legally, that's a legal definition, but to people who are deficient in conscience, lacking in empathy, impulsive, self and other destructive people, a very small percentage of the population that causes a great deal of social difficulty. Now, what makes people think that these disorders have, I didn't mention the statistics for the other things, but the antisocial personalities are about perhaps 5, 6% of men and less than 1% of women. In cultures that drink, about 10% of people who drink become alcohol dependent. So that means that if there are genetic factors, that a very large fraction of the population has a proclivity, a tendency, to get addicted to an extraordinarily toxic substance. Okay. what makes us think the things run in families? Well, I would say normal intelligence. My same extremely bright Lithuanian grandmother would say, why are you wasting time proving the obvious? But aside from appealing to my grandmother, I can be pedantic. I wouldn't be terribly pedantic. I do collect funny quotes from different centuries when I am browsing in a kind of obsessional pedantic way in libraries, kind of withdrawing from the world and picking up dusty volumes. And I once picked up a dusty volume entitled The London Practice of Physic, which was published in 1685. And it read, it is a common observation that children born, these words are going to come out very funny, but they're right, children born of men who are wont, likely to be mad, are obnoxious to the same disposition, which is a funny 17th century way of saying it runs in families. Okay, at the beginning of this century, following Mendel and people studying peas and sweet peas, began to study the exact extent to which psychiatric disorders ran in families. And what they found was, they counted noses. If, for example, a woman has a serious biological depression and she's married to a man who doesn't have any whatsoever, what fraction of their kids will have those kinds of problems? And does it depend on whether the kids are male or female? And people counted this way, and they assumed that since it ran in families, it must be genetic, until some very reasonable person said, so does speaking English run in families. And as a matter of fact, it runs more in families than having red hair, at least without Miss Clairol. So having red hair must be learned, and speaking English must be genetic. And this was a nasty thing to do. It's the kind of thing that academics do to one another. Someone then got the clever idea that perhaps twins would solve the problem. And twins have been very popular in human genetics. And twins have been very popular because identical monozygotic twins ostensibly share exactly the same genes, whereas fraternal twins, dizygotic twins, are formed by two eggs developing separately in their mother's uterus. So aside from the odd experience of pre-birth, they are no more closely related than any pair of siblings, to be sure of the same age. And if something is genetic, so it was reasoned, if one twin has it, so does the other, if they are identical. And if they are fraternal, if they are non-identical, if one twin has it, the odds are that the other twin has it are no more than if they're brother and sister. Well, that was okay until some more people came back and said, yes, but being a twin is a very peculiar state of affairs. People are apt to name them very similarly, to dress them in similar clothes. And if you've ever known twins, there are some who develop a real pathological dependence on one another and are overly close to one another, and perhaps things might be psychologically infectious in that regard. I've summarized 62 years of or thereabouts of academic dispute until about 1962. In my intellectual career, I've always been discovering fire and the wheel. I would rush into my physics teacher and say, I got a tremendous idea. And then she would let me down very gently and say, someone had thought of that 400 years before. Well, it was terrific for my sense of humility. It's amazing I stayed creative at all. I could give up. Well, finally, in 1962, for reasons that still remain entirely obscure in my mind, I had the idea that perhaps one could finesse this whole issue of nature and nurture, of heredity and environment, by studying adopted people. And that's what I mean by saying it's a fairly simple-minded idea, because adoption is a kind of social experiment in which we raise people who have one set of biological parents who give them their genes and another set who provide their environment. And in a kind of simple-minded idea, you might ask, what happens to someone whose biological mother is schizophrenic and who is placed in a normal home compared to someone comparable who stays with that schizophrenic mother, or someone who's born of a normal pair of parents and is raised by schizophrenic parents. Well, they're kind of hard to find such people, and back in 63, when I presented this idea, I found the two other people at the National Institutes of Health had had the same idea at the same time. We collaborated and have had a very fruitful scientific collaboration for the past, God help us, over a score of years. And because we didn't feel willing or wanting to investigate all psychiatric disorders, a number of our colleagues have investigated other ones using the same population in Denmark. But before we hit upon Denmark, for reasons I will tell you about briefly, in 1963, I became the father of monozygotic twins. I felt this must be some symbolic act of God. And I had what I thought was really a world-shaking idea, in that we would give one of the girls away to the kind of family which is supposed to promote schizophrenia. And this immediately met with two violent objections. One was on the part of their mother, who objected to breaking up a matched pair. And the other, more forceful, was from a colleague of mine who suggested that any father to whom this occurred should give both of the girls away to a normal father. Well, through a long, involved, not particularly interesting story, we wound up in Denmark because Denmark has terrific records. And with the basis of a promise of confidentiality, we were able in Denmark, for example, to locate the name of every adopted person adopted by non-relatives. There's a central registry of mental illness in Denmark, so that if you're given the name of an adopted person, it lists the name of his biological, her biological mother, the putative father, and one can go to the register of disease and see, well, did the father have cancer? Did he have heart disease? Did he have schizophrenia? And let's see what happens to the son who was adopted away. And lastly, in Denmark, as in most European countries, which is a kind of huge civil rights infringement to Americans, every time you move, you have to register with the police. So you can locate everybody. I then learned to my horror that actually you used to be able to do the same thing through Visa or MasterCard, who would supply you with also the information about how many gin bottles were in the garbage pail. But anyway, so Denmark, we were able to locate the populations we wanted, and to answer, and I will give you a concrete question, a fact I was just telling Dr. Stout earlier today of a study we just finished about the role of genetic factors in suicide, which is obviously an ethical issue of great importance. And I said, this is very simple-minded. I'll tell you what we did. It's simple-minded, the idea, the administrative carrying out of the ideas is extremely laborious. We located the names of every adult in the Kingdom of Denmark who was adopted at a very early age by people to whom he or she is not related and who was, back in 1980, seriously depressed. And for each man or woman we found that way, we located the name of another adoptee of the same age, the same sex, raised in a family background that was approximately comparable. And we asked the very simple question, among others, if depression runs in families, then the depressed adoptee ought to have more depression among his, or the group of depressed adoptees ought to have more depression among their mothers and fathers, their siblings and half-siblings, than we would find among the mothers and fathers of a non-depressed adoptee, though they'd never seen them. Runs in families. Dr. Stout, my half-brother, whom I've never met, is more likely to be depressed than if I am not depressed right now as the adoptee. Since we know depressed people commit suicide, we can also ask of the depressed adoptees, what was the rate of depression among their relatives, and what was the rate of suicide? We came up with the mind-blowing finding, which we've been chewing over and working over just before submitting to publication, that if one is depressed this way, the risk that one's relatives will commit suicide is 15 times as great. with an overwhelming proclivity to commit suicide. I want to say just a thing, make a point or two about suicide and review what I said and sit down. By the way, I'm sure you're as glad as I that I have no lantern slides. It is late in the afternoon. I shall be brief. Suicide is the second leading cause of death in kids and adolescents. And its relation, accidents are the first. I mean, bad things like leukemia are actually way down the list. So data such as these are relevant not only ethically, but in terms of survival of kids and to a greater extent adolescents. What's going on with children is very unclear. What's going on with adolescents is both depression and social factors in which something such as suicide becomes infectious, but there are obviously genetic ones as well. Okay, just to summarize what I said, there are several different syndromes of psychopathology, schizophrenia, disorders of mood, depression, that was, alcohol and drug abuse, criminality, and some forms of antisocial personality, that these disorders clearly run in families, that the major question which has been perplexing us is to what extent this running in families is determined by heredity or environment, and that these genetic studies have enabled us to begin to piece apart the extent to which genetic factors play a role. Finally, that these disorders in their rare and severe forms and their mild and more common forms affect between 15% and 30% of the population. And as one last comment, lest you think that that is completely out of whack, that something psychotic is going on, no, it isn't, because the same thing is happening in medicine. And that is to say, although fats may promote heart disease, many people can live on heavy cream and butter and be hit by a car at 90. And it appears to be the case that many people with severe medical illnesses, to which there are clear environmental contributions, such as smoking or being overweight or eating fats, are, and perhaps as many as 40%, have major genetic contributions to their common medical difficulties. Okay, I think I've got in 18 minutes, so with 2 minutes to spare, I will stop. Thank you.
No apology here necessarily. The phone call that brought me here came some weeks ago and invited me first to a panel, part of the symposium dealing with issues of sexuality in the gospel. Then a second phone call, in fact, changed the topic altogether to issues of moral responsibility, ethical responsibility, and so on, in conjunction with clinical practice. I indicated then that I am no clinician, and was told, well, how about representing the behavior modification point of view, since you do that sort of thing with animals in your research? And so I consented, tried to be obliging. I'm very sympathetic to the purposes of the Sunstone Symposia, and then found myself, when the program arrived, to be curiously identified with this topic of behaviorism and the gospel. And if that isn't a strange enough juxtaposition, that nested under the topic, the new psychobiology and moral responsibility. So I'm something of a stranger in your midst indeed. I presume that the new psychobiology, we've had references to it already today, the new psychobiology refers to developments over the last decade or so in a variety of areas that have caused a great deal of public interest and excitement about the potential of techniques to ameliorate a number of conditions that are of concern. Such things as the discovery of techniques for imaging goings on in the brain, large-scale, global, social goings on in the brain, if you will, the CT scan, first of all, followed by the PET scan, and now more recently a a technique safer than those, not requiring any invasion, any injection of labeled substances and so on, so-called NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance techniques, that allow us to profile differential activity in certain portions of the brain so as to be able to say, aha, this area more active than this, and begin some kind of more robust and reliable functional mapping of the goings-on in the brain. It's a very exciting set of developments indeed. Another, probably more familiar to you, has to do with the development of certain kinds of psychosurgical techniques, the most common being the colostomectomy or commissurotomy that has been performed in a very limited number of patients suffering severe epilepsy, the so-called split brain operation first performed 20-odd years ago with humans, and the intriguing, fascinating kinds of changes that occur in such individuals, changes revealed only under very precise experimental conditions. But all of this giving rise to the notion of hemispheric specialization, left-brained individuals versus right-brained versus ambi-brained or whatever, that has promoted a great deal of interest and curiosity in the public mind, and made some people very famous indeed, as they've capitalized on this metaphor of the left brain versus right brain individual. Other developments then have come pharmacologically, if you will, psychopharmacologically, the discovery of substances that have potent effects in the amelioration of various kinds of pathological, psychopathological conditions. Some of this already alluded to today. The discovery of that interesting family of polypeptides, the so-called endorphins, and their almost magical effects, it seems, on the control of pain and their relatedness to clinical conditions such as schizophrenia and the like. So, just holding up a few samples, we can point to this very exciting thing called the new psychobiology, and with that sort of affiliated in the clinical domain, a title from Professor Wunder's remark, or a word from Professor Wunder's title, that being the psychiatric revolution, which in some ways sort of fits together with this new psychobiology that we have alluded to. So with that as something of a preface in terms of what I'm viewing the new psychology as, let me talk about behaviorism and return to sort of the old psychobiology, as it were, to trace some roots. Now, I don't wear a badge. I am a behaviorist or anything of that sort. It would be an unpopular thing to do, I think. But it's true that I have trained with individuals who have no compunction about calling themselves that, including B.F. Skinner, the sort of arc behaviorist, if you will. And so I'm prepared to talk somewhat about the point of view that is represented by that member of the family of behaviorism, that is Skinner's thought, or as it is often referred to, radical behaviorism, to counter-distinguish it from the other forms of behaviorism that are historically significant. Although it's possible to point in a very definitive way to the work of Descartes as being germinal to what we have referred to in this century as behaviorism, I will start rather with a 19th century reflexologist, physiologist, reflexologist, psychobiologist by the name of Ivan Sechenov. Russia at that particular era was the site of a great deal of very active interest and very important work in the effort to derive brain models of behavior, that is to point to correspondences or correlations between happenings in the nervous system, brain in particular, as could be observed through the rather crude instruments of the time, and observable overt actions on the part of the creature being studied, most often non-human animals. Sechenov was interested primarily in the effect of the brain on behavior, and there were at least two possible classes of effects excitatory effects, that is to say, stimulation of the brain in some sense excited behavior, made it more rapid in its occurrence or made its occurrence more frequent, and then some other, and then just the opposite way, an inhibitory effect on behavior. Stimulation of the brain slowing some behavior down, causing it to occur less frequently, whatever. And the behaviors of interest were those things titled reflexes, classes of behavior that were highly reliable in terms of the conditions of origin, similarity and expression from occasion to occasion or elicitation to elicitation, whatever. So, and in his case, one of the reflexes he studied intensely was the leg flexion reflex of the frog. He had a way of measuring the arc of the reflex, that is how far the leg actually went out from the frog's body, and also the amount of time occupied by the reflex. And this was measurable in a very systematic way. He then, in various preparations, would stimulate the brain. And this was often accomplished by removing the animal's scalp so as to expose the brain and sprinkling table salt on it. Just a sort of easily replicated form of stimulation. And what he found in this case was that that kind of excitation or stimulation led to a slowing of the reflex. That is, clearly the brain acted in an inhibitory fashion in this case. Now, just the opposite procedure, that is, removing the effect of brain stimulation, was accomplished by removing the brain, which he did. The animal continues to behave quite normally for a period of time, long enough to do these experiments, and what he found is was that removal of the brain caused just the opposite effect. That is to say, without the brain, the reflex was excited, if you will. So there seemed to be this nice kind of polar model available, stimulation of the brain producing one set of effects, the absence of stimulation producing the opposite set, and so on. And this, in turn, led to some interesting philosophizing on his part, because he began to ask questions about human experience based on these, by our standards, certainly primitive, crude animal models, and blended with this the classical physics of the day, and started asking questions like, where do our actions come from? Those premeditated as well as those not. And he, in attempting to sort this out, grabbed hold of the notion in classical physics of conservation of energy and matter, and with those notions, affiliated notions of types of energy, kinetic versus potential, for example. And summing very quickly, he reasoned that all action is caused, and that the cause is always locatable beyond the skin. Now, this flies in the face of most of our Western intuitions, which see us as somehow the originating locus of what we do in most cases. There is this incredible phenomenal experience that we have that we call, often would label, consciousness. And with that, any number of instances that we could easily point out where I have the impression that my action originates with me. Why did you do that? Because I wanted to. Or I thought about it and then I did it. Or any number of common illusions of this sort. Illusions of this sort. For Sechenov, such expressions and such and this sort of referential scheme represented our vast, and were the consequence, if you will, of our vast ignorance of the real causes of action. For him, we in essence tell a story when the real cause in the external environment is not pointable. either because it is simply beyond our means to perceive, or we simply haven't perceived it as yet. And so in this kind of explanatory vacuum, that is to say, where there is no readily identifiable, assignable cause for what we've done, we essentially invent fictions. And the mind, if you will, is the sort of sum total, in many ways, of such fictions. Providing some kind of explanatory flow, some reasonability, some logic to the account of for action, why we do what we do. Well, this Sechenov's work had profound effect on a student of the next generation whose name was Pavlov, who came along with much the same kind of interest intact, and we know what he did. Pavlov's work found its way in translation. This is after he won the Nobel Prize in 1906 and turned his attention more to things psychological, found his way in translation and eventually into the hands of a young, newly PhD'd professor at Johns Hopkins by the name of John Watson, who became very intrigued with it indeed. Watson was this sort of person on the meteoric climb to great fame. At a very early age, president of the American Psychological Association, I'm told, a handsome, charismatic man who had great command. And Watson invented the term behaviorism, popularized it all in a very short period of time, and then any number of behaviorisms sort of followed from that, and it became entrenched and was essentially the prevailing philosophy in psychology for the better part of this century. Pavlov's work also found its way into the hands of Bertrand Russell, who was impressed by the logical possibilities inherent in it in terms of the logic of the explanation of behavior, wrote a very positive, favorable review published in a little British intellectual journal, Dial, that was picked up by this itinerant poet 2 years beyond his undergraduate degree in English in Greenwich Village, there at the encouragement of Robert Frost. His career had foundered, and he was looking to return to graduate school, but what to study, and picked up this little magazine one night and read the article by Bertrand Russell and decided that's what to study, the causes of behavior, and that was B.F. Skinner. Skinner followed right along with the reflexologists, all behavior caused by things on the outside, all behavior in essence reflexive, but then further thinking and his own doctoral research and so on, began to categorize types of reflexes, if you will, and ultimately to dichotomize types of reflexes into those things that are respondents, as he termed them, and those things that are operants, if you will. That distinction is really not important. Much more important was the emphasis he put on explanation residing in the consequences of action, the whole story told there for him. And the technology, or let's be more respectable and say the science of behavior, the experimental analysis of behavior that was spun off from his work, represents this effort to identify the causal structure of action by explicit attention to the environment beyond the skin. And the functional relationship between the happenings, variables, if you will, in that environment and behavior itself. Now, much more recently, this particular position has proven quite compatible with emerging models of evolution generally. In fact, Skinner published a paper about 4 years ago in Science entitled Selection by Consequences, in which he pointed out the rather interesting, if not remarkable, parallels between the position that he takes in terms of where behavior comes from and the position of neo-Darwinians, the neo-Darwinist models of evolution by means of natural selection. Namely that species of organisms, if we're talking about biological evolution, and species of behavior, if you will, are in essence formed by the consequences of action. That is to say, there's some kind of active selection mechanism that brings out just certain things while other things become extinguished. This agent, if you will, of selection is what Skinner would perhaps cavalierly refer to as contingencies. There are contingencies residing in the universe. Contingencies of reinforcement, contingencies of punishment. That is to say, lawful, to use a very pejorative phrase, relationships between what an individual does, or some piece of behavior, or some community of animals, or whatever, and the consequences of that action or behavior. And so, again, he's sort of pointing to the fact that modification of behavior, learning, and so on, seems to, in a general sense, obey the very same processes that we see at work in the population of the planet over the course of evolutionary time. That is to say, there's this convergence of causalities, convergence of causal mechanisms. Out of all possible causal mechanisms, these have evolved. And isn't it interesting that they've evolved for phenomena at very basic levels of organization, as well as for phenomena at very complex levels of organization. Now, what to say, finally, to psychobiology, and what to say to the gospel, given the foundation laid. First of all, Skinner is in no way insensitive to biology or to psychobiology, physiological psychology, whatever one might want to call it. But for him, the level of discourse, the level of analysis, the level of interest is in many ways premature. He wouldn't say let's eliminate such study altogether, but say rather it's premature. And before it can succeed, there needs to be a careful mapping of the relationships between behavior and environment. Behavior seen as some kind of emergent phenomenon in some hierarchy of complexity, emergent phenomenon above the phenomena of the nervous system. So that only by essentially identifying lawful relationships at this level is one ready to go some step deeper. And so in his way, psychology is what you do to give the psychobiologists their lead. In other words, by identifying those things lawful at the level of behavior, then you essentially give warrant to what the neurobiologists should look at. Well, of course, that's not a particularly popular view, but that is at least one way of bridging between the point of view that we loosely refer to as behaviorism and what goes on in the name of neurobiology or psychobiology. And then, lastly, what to say about the gospel here. And anything I would say would be, I think, terribly presumptuous of me. I should simply say that in attempting to make a behavioristic account, which may be disrespectful of the gospel, but in attempting to make some kind of at least preliminary behavioristic account of it, one can conceive of the gospel as a collection of contingencies, some of which are imparted in a kind of rule-governed fashion. That is to say, there are two ways by which to come in contact with contingencies. One can do it without the instrumentality of other individuals, other verbal individuals, or one can do it with the instrumentality of verbal individuals who say, do this, don't do that. Without my ever having done those things, I behave in accordance with what I'm told. That is to say, rule-governed behavior, or behavior under the control of rules as contingencies. And the gospel might be framed in that way, as a set of discriminative stimuli, to use Skinner's phrase, as a set of expressions of contingencies. If one will do the following, or even phrased more forcefully in the case of the context of moral responsibility, you should do this, and if you do, or you must do this, and if you do, then certain things will occur. Now, often it's those certain things that occur that are elusive where the gospel is concerned. Often elusive because they are projected to some distant point in the future, making those things very difficult to contact behavior in the here and now. So we give a fair amount of time to conceptualizing that repository of rewards and punishers, and this is by no means unique to the LDS version of the gospel, those things that lie in the future as a way of somehow vivifying them so they can have impact on what we do in the present. And then, and I will close here, we expect that adherence to the contingencies stipulated by the gospel or by those who represent it in some institutional form as the church will make contact with the behavior of individuals to produce certain kinds of desirable actions, certain kinds of uniformity in the way in which adherents behave, and ultimately some kind of society that in the overall scheme of contingencies, if you will, is highly favored, selected, chosen, whatever one might want to say. Well, in this haphazard way, I've tried to point to little pieces of logic that may, in some way, however clumsy, allow these things, the gospel, behaviorism, psychobiology, moral responsibility, to make contact one with another.
We will have time for a few questions. I would first like to be your spokesman and tell these three gentlemen that we appreciate the quality and relevance of their comments. I'll take advantage very briefly of my position. As all of them spoke, I had a flood of recall how we're all in the same boat trying to orient ourselves in contradictions. As Dr. Stout was speaking, I recalled the time when I was a member of a high council in another city. Three men, relatively young, came to me and said, Dr. Taylor, I was a psychiatrist, and I can tell you in those days it was not easy being a psychiatrist and a high councilman. I guess it still isn't. But they said, will you come and speak to us, a rather large group of members of the stake who are homosexual, and tell us what our role in the church is? I said, I can't do that. I'll ask the stake president. I didn't give any names. I went to the stake president to ask him the question. He said, Ben, I don't know what you're going to tell him. I went back and said, I can't speak to you because I don't speak definitively for the church. Very shortly thereafter, two of these three persons received a 10-year pin from the MIA for meritorious and wonderful service to the youth of the church. Now, I'm not expressing my posture now about homosexuality or anything, but the matter of contradiction. And how does one orient themselves? Because after all, the topic in general is psychobiology and the new moral posture. As Paul was speaking about schizophrenia and suicide, I recall over a period of years, I didn't sit around analyzing people and keeping notes, but I observed Charlie, let me call him Charlie, not such a good-looking kid, young boy, grown up in the church. He wasn't received well by his peers. The fair daughters of Zion, if I can use that term, were not enthused about him. Reality. Anyway, Charlie, over a period of years, I would try to reach out, but, I have my responsibility. I have my limitations. I saw Charlie drift away. I saw him become isolated. I saw these precursors to the overt psychotic state. I saw him get depressed. He developed a schizophrenia, and guess what? Charlie did. Charlie ended his life. And as the professor King, this business of the brain, and I have kids who are into these machines, MRIs and all this sort of stuff, and the old question comes to my mind, what is the brain? Is it a vast organic, physical, chemical, biologic complexity only, Or, you know, dare I raise the question, is the brain a duality? Is it strictly organic and therefore behavior determined, or is it a duality and is there such a thing as a mind independent of the brain, a spirit, a soul? Now, you know, it isn't only just a matter of the morality of what am I going to do and what will I participate in. It's a matter of how am I going to relate to these, my fellow men. How am I going to relate to Charlie? How am I going to relate to these people, these three fellows that I mentioned? And believe me, I've known a lot, as has Dr. Stout. Contradictions. Where do we orient ourselves now in the light of the wisdom and knowledge and the biology and everything else that we have available to us, as far as not only what do I do, what's my behavior, but what's my responsibility in these things, and in the very difficult task of reducing and living with contradiction? For that preparation, we certainly would welcome any questions, and if you can state them loud enough to be heard, fine. If not, I shall repeat them and direct them to any member of the panel you choose. Yes, sir.
I believe there is some of this that goes on, certainly in the bisexual world, it's been called. People are trying new experiments, moving back and forth to different lifestyles, trying anything that is stimulating. I'm sure some people have experimented with this for those reasons. But I think the majority would always return to the sexual preference of their choice that was rooted down inside of them. There have been cases in prisons, of course, where we all know that men become homosexual in prisons. And even some who reportedly prefer homosexuality after coming out of prisons when they have been heterosexual prior to that time. But I think those are the aberrations. I think you know, the rootedness of sexual identity, I think, is something kind of inherent with us. It has to be worked through all the different environmental factors that I talked about also, and the family constellation shape these things. But the point I wanted to make and wanted to really get over is that we can't just sit back and kind of smugly assume that we know homosexuals choose their lifestyle and that somehow they are consciously choosing to sin and go against the church. They agonize with what they do. They're not happy with it. They're not pleased. I had one fellow tell me that if there was a pill we could develop tomorrow, he would be first in line. He would scramble over dozens of other people to change his sexual preference. So it's not something lightly entered into by very many people.
Now, sir, may I interrupt briefly? We appreciate your comments, but we should direct questions to the members of the panel. Do you have a question, sir?
Well, this is probably your right.
Yes, right. Before Dr. Stout responds to that, I also was in the military and processed out 500 or so people, and I was disenchanted that somebody could walk in the barracks and I could tell immediately whether he was homosexual.
Well, certainly I didn't try to, it wasn't my intention to make this sound like it was a simplistic kind of thing. I think I went to some extent to try to say it's a very complex interplay of a lot of things. I wanted to emphasize the biological role because I think that's been overlooked. And I think it has profound implications for us. In the case of female homosexuals, and while I didn't speak to them very much, I made some reference to them in terms of the adrenogenital syndrome. The presumption and the theoretical thing is that somehow, in the female embryo, testosterone is produced by the adrenal glands of females, not necessarily by their mothers. And they produce excessive amounts of testosterone from their own adrenal glands since they don't have testicles. And somehow, at that crucial stage of brain development or laying down those primordial imprinted lines of behavior that are ultimately going to be demonstrated, testosterone seems to be crucial for females, just like it is for males. But it is a very complex condition, and I would only say that I think we've got to be very careful where we look at family constellations because, as I mentioned earlier, I believe very much like you. I was schooled in the fact that that there were certain family constellations that produced homosexuality. But again, as I brought out in my paper, there have been large studies which have refuted this because we are all looking at cases who seek us out, and we tend to see stories that reinforce our own beliefs. It's a very complex set of circumstances. I wanted the audience to feel the complexity and agonize with it rather than just look at homosexuals as some people who just kind of made some horrible wrong turn in their lives and and they're going to be responsible for that from then on. Thank you.
We could take one more question, and then perhaps the members of the panel would be available after we officially close. Yes, sir.